I'll open the, June 24th meeting of the House Committee on Environment and Energy.
11 o'clock, 11?
We have a forum, in fact, I think everybody's here.
Start the right foot, man.
Bernie's visiting the.
The summit meeting.
Summit meeting.
Summit.
We're not supposed to work here.
Not your what? Figured summit had to be had.
Nothing on white standards.
You better announce it. Huh?
Nothing on white.
You better announce it.
Nothing on white.
Because the people are all over the place.
Sorry, Kim.
People are all over the place.
The committee.
Well, take a vote, see what.
Yeah, well, hold on, we don't still, we just have to get the other.
I thought this was our last meeting.
Except on call. We will not be doing anything except for 572. Let me announce, we will not be doing a 572 today. Let me.
We're half our audience.
Yeah, I know. Are we ready to move on 3475?
Yes.
I'll open the work session on House Bill 3475. Representative Keesley.
Yes, Mr. Chair, following the hearing and work session on Wednesday, I was instructed to sit down with John Charles and the Oregon Forest Industries Council and the Department of Forestry to work out this bill on prescribed burning. What you have before you, both the hand engrossed version and set of amendment. Would you like me to briefly walk?
Yes.
You through what the bill would do? The bill, in section two, prescribes what the general policy is, which is to improve the management of prescribed burning where it's done, and also to minimize emissions from such burning consistent with.
Wine cooler. There's all your wine cooler.
Air quality objectives.
Excuse me, I announce we will not be doing anything with that bill. Thank you. Go ahead.
Federal Clean Air Act and the plan that's the Department of Environmental Quality is monitoring. What we have in section three, and this is where some of the language has been changed in terms of the kinds of programs that would be expanded on under this act. We see that on page 1B. Collection analysis of information regarding prescribed burning and other alternative slash management techniques. One thing we did in here is we interjected language in several important places relating to collecting information on and evaluating alternatives to burning. We see that both in A and B. We go back to the original bill in the language here. We go to, on 1B, provides for a five-person committee. Two representatives from industry, two from the federal government, and one public member.
Now, where are we at this point, Phil?
That's section four. That's relatively, that's unchanged.
Well, that says, I thought it says three members, not five.
No, but there's one member, there's a total of five members on the committee. Three of them are appointed by the forester.
All right, thank you.
Another two from the Forest Service and the BLM. Section five charges the advisory committee with some tasks that weren't in the original bill. First of all, with relation to collecting information about prescribed burning operations, there's a general feeling that we lack some important information, such as amount of emissions attributable to some of these burns, information about when they might be most effective. To give advice to the State Forestry Department on how to go about doing that, and then to review and comment on the report that's required under section six of the act. Section six calls for a report from the State Forestry Department, submit to the Legislative Assembly. I think it's important, sub two, about modifications to the smoke management plan. It's the, number three, analysis of appropriate short-term and long-term strategies for reducing emissions from prescribed burning and for implementing alternative techniques for managing slash and woody material. Techniques are economically feasible, environmentally sound. Purpose, in my mind, and I think in the minds of the group, that we use this change, and it's a two-year change, emphasize that again, it's going to sunset in 1991, but that we use this opportunity as a way to engage the legislature, engage the interested parties in looking at this whole area of prescribed burning and slash management, which we have not done as much on as many of us would like, and that this report will play a very important role in that. And I think, as the committee also recalls, that the program is going to be funded by fees that are collected for burning. $1.50 per acre and 50 cents per registration. The first time, really, that the burning program has been funded in that way. That's a significant change. But the final portion of the bill, which is Section 9, that repeals the act in December 31, 1991, means that this legislature is going to have to evaluate whether we want to continue to do that or not. Gives us an opportunity to analyze the information that's collected over the next 2 years. I think, as the committee might recall, there was some concern when the bill came up last Wednesday that this might move us in an opposite direction than, let's say, what we were looking at with field burning, which is trying to reduce the amount of emissions into the air from certain practices. It's the feeling of the working group that having given the advisory committee some broader charges and direction to look not just at prescribed burning, but to look at alternatives, that this is going to be a constructive piece of the total effort this legislature is going to need to take in 1991 to look at a range of outdoor clean air issues. And let me add one final thing, Mr. Chair. It was suggested that the date for when this report was submitted to the legislature be changed from September 15, 1990 to January 1, 1991. I think actually that's a good change. It'll give us a little bit more time in two complete burning seasons to do the report. I don't think the legislature, the interim committee in the fall of 1990 is going to have a chance to take much action on that. We'd have it at the beginning of the session. And I think that change is acceptable to the various parties in the negotiation, and I think that would help. That's on the hand engrossed, that's Section 6, first line, Section 6. I'm happy to answer any questions, and there are a number of people here who worked with me on this to get it out.
Give us an indication of who the people were you worked with.
Worked with Ray Wilkinson, Ward Armstrong, John Charles, Fred Robinson and Mike of the Department of Forestry.
Everybody on board on this?
Everybody's on board on this.
Okay. You make a motion for the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'd move with that change of January 1, 1991, in the amendments.
Representative, we have a motion to
adoption of the 3475-4 amendments.
Okay, we've got a motion to adopt the proposed amendments. Representative Jones.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, not knowing whether this fiscal impact has to go anywhere else, that's my question.
Well, that is a good point. I think we have a second referral. That was a ways of means.
Yes. Is it a way to? Yes.
It's such as a fee basis.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Weehead.
Just a couple of questions about those fees. It's 50 cents per acre for registration of any forest land that's going to be burned that particular year, and then $1.50 per acre for forest land classified as Class 1. I'm not sure I understand the difference. How much forest land is Class 1 that would be subject to the $1.50, and why the difference? What's the difference between burning Class 1 forest land and burning non-Class 1 forest land?
Let me have
defer to the technical experts.
One of the two of you come up a minute. Three, all three of you. Sorry.
Representative Cease, members of the committee, I'm Fred Robinson, State Forestry Department. With me is Mike Ziolko, who is our smoke management coordinator. Representative Wheathodge, the question, as I understand it, is what acres does the 50 cents apply to and what acres does the additional dollar and a half apply to? The 50 cents would apply to all acres that are burned, and right now we're talking about 100,000 acres per year. Well, I should say all acres that are registered and burned. Now, as what we anticipate happening with this is there will be very few acres that are registered and not burned. Right now, there is a little more slop between acres planned that go into our system as planned and acres that actually get burned. But we suspect that forest landowners that, you know, will plan less acres than they intend to burn, and there'll be very little difference. So I think the answer is we anticipate that this thing will work out to about $2 an acre for all acres that are burned, and not a significant amount of revenue beyond that.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Is your desire to move this through Ways and Means and become law?
Mr. Chairman, Ward Armstrong with the Oregon Forest Industry Council. The answer to that is yes. And my understanding is the reason for Ways and Means is to authorize the positions. It's self-funding.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? Not. Is there an objection to the amendments? Representative Keesley.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3475 is amended to the Ways and Means Committee with the due pass recommendation.
We move to send House Bill 3475 as amended to Ways and Means with the due pass recommendation. Any additional comment? Now, if the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Dix.
Aye.
Representative Hostica.
Aye.
Representative Jones.
Aye.
Representative Keesley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Parkinson.
Aye.
Representative Pickard.
Aye.
Representative Wehage.
Aye.
Chair Cease.
Aye. Motion carries, and I will close the work session on House Bill 3475. Thank Representative Keesley and the group for doing it. Appreciate it. Let me open the public hearing on Senate Bill 70. Let me ask Ron Ekus and Mike Kane from the PUC if they'll come up. Welcome.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dix.
Were you going to share with witnesses today how we'd like them to be brief?
Yes. Representative Dix wants you to understand that Kane would like you to be brief. He's anxious. He has a trigger finger. He wants to move motion.
Pew, pew, pew.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I will try and be brief. Senate Bill 70, the engrossed version you have, allows the Public Utility Commission to do deferred accounting for telecommunications utilities in the same way we have the authority to do deferred accounting for the energy utilities. During the last session, the legislature passed authorization for deferred accounting for energy utilities. Telecommunications was not covered. And at the same time, they passed legislation that created separate statutory scheme. The commission felt that the tools of the rate-making tool of deferred accounting had some appropriate usages in the telecommunications industry and introduced the bill that would give us parallel authority. There were some objections and some concerns by the telecommunications utilities. What we ended up with was a bill that does give us the authority to do deferred accounting, but limits that use to some specific instances. What the bill does not include is some general language that is in the energy utility deferred accounting, but the utilities were to some extent worried about that. We met with the utilities and agreed upon this language. The exception, I think you will hear some dissenting testimony. The amendments that will be suggested, we do not support, with the exception of one change in language, of changing where we have the word profits, of changing the word to amounts.
Where would that appear?
Where is that specific?
Mr. Chairman, it's on page 2, line 10. And the change would be increases or decreases, and you would strike profits realized and add amounts incurred. So it would read increases or decreases in amounts incurred by a telecommunications utility, etc.
Thank you.
In general, we feel the bill it parallels the what happens in energy. It's balanced. The issue of deferred accounting has two phases. One is whether or not to actually defer the account. The second phase is whether or not to amortize at any point in time the rates that are deferred, or the amounts that are deferred into rates. At the first stage, the issue of deferred accounting can be raised by either the utility, by ratepayers, or in the commission's own motion. The commission has to make a decision to defer the account. And we believe it's balanced also in the sense that deferred accounting can benefit the utilities as often as it can benefit the ratepayers. You will hear in testimony a concern that it's not balanced, but I don't see any way that we can make it any more balanced. The concern is that the commission has the hammer, but frankly, that's what we're here for, and we do have the hammer. We're the decision makers, and I don't think you can eliminate us from having the hammer unless you eliminated the statutory responsibility of the PUC. We feel it is very balanced. We feel it is an appropriate application of a rate-making tool that parallels what we have in the other industries that we regulate. We have reached agreement with most of the industry on the specifics, and it does limit the instances in which we can use deferred accounting.
Questions? Thank you very much. Orrin Floyd. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Orrin Floyd. I'm with the United Telephone of the Northwest. And I am here to talk about Senate Bill 70 in relation to some of the concerns that we have. We think there were basically two reasons why the bill was introduced, the first being that the commission would like to have the opportunity to capture some unanticipated revenues, such as those that occurred or could have occurred during the, or as a result of the 1986 Tax Reform Act. The second is a concern to all utilities, and that is, and to the commission as well, and that is the idea of regulatory lag, trying to find some way to smooth out the rate-making process so that you do not have sharp and frequent increases or decreases in rates, and we agree with that part of the bill. Our first concern, though, is with the balance of the bill. As Commissioner Ickes spoke, he said he could not think of a way that the bill could be balanced so that the commission didn't have the hammer. That was their authority. In thinking about that, one of our concerns is that deferred accounting can be initiated by application of a utility, a ratepayer, or on the commission's own motion. And then there has to be some kind of hearing or rulemaking that would allow for the commission to approve of the deferred account as to whether it was going to be there or not. And our concern about that is the commission's own motion, number one. If they made such a motion, chances are that was going to be approved. But if a utility came in and applied for deferred accounting, there was no assurance at all that you could get the deferred account if the commission disagreed with you, probably you wouldn't get it. And yet, there would be a legitimate reason for it if the bill was adopted, because these things are outlined in the bill, or there's things outlined in the bill that would apply to deferred accounting. So what we were thinking that we would like to see some way where there was a balance. For example, if we did come in and apply for a deferred account and it fell under one of the categories that were approved, then it would automatically be, it would go forward from that date. And subsequently, there would be a decision made in the rate-making process when you were in a rate case as to whether that would be an allowable expense or allowable revenues, whatever the case may be. We're also concerned that the bill could be a potential hunting license for any unanticipated things, or let me back up a minute. Let's say that there were some revenues produced for some reason or another, and I can't think of a reason right now except the Tax Act is a good example. Almost anybody could apply under this bill for a deferred account. The Citizens Utility Board, for example, any ratepayer, and the commission. But again, the company or the firm is at a disadvantage in that upon application, it doesn't have to be approved if the commit or the utility was to apply. So we're concerned about the imbalance of the bill. As a suggestion, what we thought we would like to see is that the items, there are 10 paragraphs that define where deferred accounting would occur. And we thought that if the paragraphs that were, if it was limited only to those things that were outside the control of management of a company, that would be the way the bill would be most appropriate and acceptable to us. And thus, we would recommend that you would eliminate all the paragraphs with the exception of A, C, and D, and that we would amend I to read increases or decreases in amounts occurred by a telecommunications utility resulting from changes mandated by the FCC, the commission, or a legislative body with respect to depreciation rates, accounting methods, tariff prices, expense allocations, and serving arrangements such as extended area service or boundary changes or mandated single-party service. And then the last change we'd recommend is that, in the very least, if all 10 of the areas were retained in the bill, that J, as Commissioner Ekus stated, J should be changed to strike the word profits and substitute, strike the words profits realized, I guess it was, and yeah, substitute the words amounts incurred. That makes it consistent all the way through.
What difference does that make? Explain to me what the significance is between those two phrases.
Well, and in all the previous paragraphs, you're dealing with either expenses or revenues, and they can be on a negative side or a positive side. But if you're dealing with profits, you're only dealing with one side of the ledger, and that is the side that's on the profit side. You're not dealing with the negative side of the ledger.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you, Mark. We're in hearing. John Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Continental California of the Northwest. Chairman, we have similar concerns to those just expressed by United. I have reviewed their testimony and concur. I think it's important to note that in the earlier testimony, it was recalled that last session you passed a bill exposing the electric other utilities to deferred accounting. And I think it's important to note that those utilities do undergo many more frequent variations from a greater number of sources in trying to purchase energy and with the fluctuation of energy costs. And so I think it makes a lot more sense to have a broader deferred vehicle there. What Senate Bill 70 in the form it was introduced in, and to a certain extent in the form it's still in, is retroactive rate making. And I think you can understand the concern of any business under those concerns. In fact, I think the PUC has even defined it as a version of retroactive rate making. And so as a consequence, we too would like to see some limitations placed upon the use of that kind of a rate making mechanism. our company services very small areas and has had rate filings on average of every 3 to 5 years. You can defer for 12 months under this plan, and then we would have to apply for an extension of those deferrals. The way it works now with that kind of fluctuation is those things are put together in a rate case and evened out over a period of time through the rate making process. So we do think that the limitations expressed by Mr. Floyd would improve the bill and recommend them for your consideration.
Questions? Thank you, John. Thank you. Dave Overstreet, is he here? Maury, why don't you come on up to, let me ask, Ray, do you want to give testimony on this bill? Come on up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dave Overstreet representing GTE Northwest. I will be very brief. GTE Northwest is neutral on this bill. We have run United's amendments by our people, however, and we feel that their amendments would make this a better bill. So we are supportive of United's amendments. That's all I have to say.
Okay. Just yes, go ahead.
I hear you say you're neutral on the bill, but you support the amendments.
We can live with the bill the way it is, but we feel that it would probably be a better bill if United's amendments are adopted.
Better neutral.
A better neutral.
I'm into words this morning. Thank you.
You need Vera's dictionary.
Mr. Astley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Maury Astley. I represent the Oregon Independent Telephone Association. And I'll be very brief, won't cover the other points people have made about the way this is unbalanced and so forth. And we're not neutral, we're just opposed to the bill. And the main reason, let me just make this point because I haven't heard it. The last two sessions, this committee has worked hard to reduce legislation, or to reduce regulation in our industry, recognizing where this industry is going and the environment that we're currently working in. This particular bill originally, last session, did include the telephone companies, and we weren't exempt because of the split bill. We were exempt because we asked for an exemption, and we received it. And I would agree that this bill can be a good or a bad bill for the industry, but it goes in the wrong direction of regulation, and we would prefer not to give the commission more regulatory powers at a time when we're reducing regulation on our industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Ray Gribbling. I represent U.S. West. We had some problems on the Senate side on this bill. We had indicated that we wanted them to be more specific to commission's actions. They have accomplished this to our satisfaction, and I did testify to that fact in the Senate. And I was only speaking for my company, U.S. West. So we are neutral on the bill.
Great. I was under the impression that this bill was originally requested by U.S. West. No, I guess that's not right. Thank you. Questions? Ron, why don't you come on up a minute? I think that's all the testimony. Is anyone else who wanted to testify on Senate Bill 70, is there? Let me close the work session, or the hearing on Senate Bill 70, and open the work session on Senate Bill 70. And, Representing Parkinson.
There seems to be one not controversial amendment I'd like to move.
I don't have any amendments in my folder.
Page 2, line 10, strike profits realized.
Right, amounts incurred.
Amounts incurred.
Is there any objection to that amendment? Not, we'll accept that. Let me ask you, Ron, I'd be interested from that. This bill is, as I recall now, is introduced at the request of the commission. From the point of view of the telephone companies, we either get neutral or opposed. Give us your sense of the nature of that conflict, would you?
I think there are several. Deferred accounting is something that had traditionally been used in the electric and natural gas rate making process because of the effect of things purchase, changes in gas purchases, changes in DPA costs, and it was designed to allow you to take unanticipated events. When you set rates, you set them for the future based upon an anticipated revenue requirement. You end up with unanticipated events. Growth, changes in capital are not the kinds of unanticipated events that I'm talking about. You have certain cost factors, many of which are similar in energy and telecommunications, many of which are not. But you have changes such as that during the period of time that those rates are in effect will change the cost or revenues of the utility. It was primarily used in the energy field, and I think what you have is a real lack of experience in the telecommunications industry of the use of deferred accounting, a great deal of uncertainty and unsurety as to how it would be used. We spent a great deal of time just trying to explain the concept and the types of instances in which it could be used. I think you do have the fear that the commission would be making decisions, but if you listen to Mr. Floyd's testimony, he would have it automatically approved for utilities, but I didn't hear any mention that ratepayers, if they applied for deferred accounting, would have their...
do not have to be at least 70% self-supporting. And in addition to that, there's a subset of facilities. Facilities for the collection, treatment, dilution, removal, and disposal of hazardous substances that do not need to be 70% self-supporting. So if I want to go out and build a garbage burner in Brook, that has to be, that does solid waste, that has to be at least 70% self-supporting.
Mm-hmm. That's okay. Correct.
If I want to go out and build an incinerator for hazardous waste in Arlington and use this, that does not have to be at least 70% self-supporting. Would that be the effect of passing this amendment to the Constitution?
Go ahead, Jim.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keesley. Only with the caveat that the state has no intent to build, and the local municipal government is not going to build, most likely build an incinerator. That would be a private activity for which these bonds wouldn't be used at all.
Okay, but if the state wanted to get into that business, we'd have that distinction.
Right.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
What's that we
hate? In terms of using state bonding to pay for something that's not real property, is this... we're paying for activities with this money. Is this unique in the state constitution? Are there any other activities that can be paid for with state debt?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wehage, I don't know the answer to that.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ostica.
The War Veterans Home and Farm Loan Program could be construed to be an activity that's paid for with state debt, I would believe.
I'd like to pose a question to Representative Hostica. How is that money used? Isn't it just used to pay for homes and farms that could be repossessed?
Well, you mean if it's secured by some tangible real assets?
That's
the question. That, yes, there probably is some.
So in that sense,
connection. I don't know what else there is in the Constitution. There's A through J in the Constitution for bonding programs.
Mm-hmm. So in that sense, this provision, this measure is unique.
Could be.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. Representative Wehage, this whole fix here to this piece of article of the Constitution is being done on the presumption that the state on its own motion is not going to issue general obligation bonds to be secured by general fund. Only on the presumption that if we issue general obligation bonds for these activities, that they will be secured by direct fees, other funds that will not be general fund obligation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Well, they're GO, they're not, they're almost a revenue bond.
Yes.
What they're gonna end up being.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dix, we explored for this purpose the issue of revenue bonds that would be secured directly by fees upon industry. We had a lot of counsel from legal counsel to DEQ that this was the preferable way to go because of interest rates and a number of, and a whole slew of technical difficulties with doing a revenue bond approach. So, but you're right that this looks very, it's a dedicated revenue stream to pay off general obligation bonds.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
I'm curious whether we've received any advice regarding this measure from bonding experts, whether this might be seen by brokers as something that might decrease the state rating for bonds.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wehage, this language was written by the legal bond counsel to the state of Oregon for DEQ. And we have worked at every stage with that counsel. They testified in the Senate committee on this bill. In fact, this whole process was done, I think Mr. Downs can testify, with intimate contact with the legal counsel to DEQ that supervises their whole pollution control bonding authority.
Let me just pursue that. So I presume that they're confident this will not decrease our bond rating in any way, having activities funded through bonding.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wehage, that's correct. Especially because any bonds issued under this specific authority would have statutory dedicated revenue stream from fees.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I would just say that, point out that there is an article, Article 11G, that talks about activities for higher education, which seems to be almost parallel language.
Right. There has, I would indicate, I would support
that. They have the and activities added in there.
Jim, on this, there's been a substantial discussion of this whole thing. It's all been worked out, I think, very closely.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dix.
Perhaps Representative Hostick or someone's got the book on their hands. Are these bonds guaranteed the same as the other bonds with the potential for a statewide property tax?
Isn't that bonds?
Yeah. That makes these golden for people.
Well, the only one statewide property tax is a specific part of the veterans program. I don't know whether that's true.
No, it's the same for 11F for higher education.
Is it?
I'm sure that these will, the guarantee on these bonds is the potential for the state to eat them by imposing a statewide property tax.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's the same thing. Yes, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
The answer is that there is a Section 4 to Section 11H. Article 11H, which says ad valorem taxes shall be levied upon all property, that gives the authority to do a property tax and back the bonds. As members know, we've never ever done it, but almost all of these bonding sections do have property tax backing.
So it makes the rating on these very,
which is limited to 1% too of that.
Are we in work session, Mr. Chair?
We will be in a minute. Is that it?
Mr. Chair, only to say that AEA will actively work to ensure passage of this in the May 1990 ballot. We actively support it, as well as a number of other groups, and we think this is an important change to the law that we'll do our best to ensure that the voters...
It's an important part of this whole...
Of the whole Superfund cleanup package.
Right. Yes. All right, I'll close the hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 41 and open the hearing. Representative Dix.
Mr. Chair, I'd move SJR 41
to forward with a due pass recommendation. Okay. Move to send the Senate Joint Resolution 41 to forward with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Jones.
Aye.
Representative Keasley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Parkinson.
Aye.
Representative Wehage.
Aye.
Representative Dix.
Aye.
Representative Hostica.
Aye.
Chair Cease.
Aye.
Motion carries, and I will close the work session on Senate Joint Resolution 41 and open the hearing on Senate Bill 913.
Language where they have and activities.
Okay, we are in hearing on 913. Ron, why don't you and Mike King come up, and I'll ask Maury Ashley to come up on this one, too. Hearing on 913.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ron Ekus, Chair of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. I have with me Mike Kane, Assistant Commissioner for Utilities, and also John Clay, who heads our Consumer Services Division, to which this bill has particular application. The PUC opposes the adoption of Senate Bill 913. By way of a little background, and I'll give a little personal background as well as a Public Utility Commissioner background. In the last legislative session, this committee had a subcommittee on telecommunications, which I chaired. We developed legislation in conjunction with the utilities and the OITA that essentially deregulated small companies serving 15,000 or less and automatically deregulated those companies and then allowed companies of that side who had affiliated interest with other telephone, larger phone companies to petition to us for deregulation. That bill essentially deregulated rates, to simplify it. We had some discussion as to how far to go with deregulation in the subcommittee. The decision was made to not include deregulation from the Public Utility Commission protections to ratepayers when it came to complaints and to medical certificates and deposit and installation charges and shutoffs, those kinds of rules that the PUC has that apply to all customers being served in the state of Oregon. Senate Bill 913 would essentially take these customers of these small companies, and it amounts to about 16,000. If you include the customers of the affiliated interests, you get up to about 30,000, somewhere between 25 and 35,000. I can't recall a specific number. And it takes them out of the purview of the PUC rules designed to protect those customers. As chair of the subcommittee, I can tell you that if that would have been included in the legislation, we would not have let it out of the subcommittee. So we oppose the bill primarily because it leaves these customers without any protection. Yet you will hear that the customers of these deregulated utilities have the option of petitioning for re-regulation to the committee, to the commission. I can envision when there is a rate increase and the people are notified of it that 10%, they may organize in 10% or they may circulate enough petitions to get signatures and come to us because of a rate increase. I cannot envision when someone is unfairly shut off or where they have a complaint with the commission or that they would otherwise apply for a certificate of medically needy that you're going to, that those isolated instances are going to generate enough to petition us to re-regulate. And essentially what this bill does is it takes a group of people and says you are not subject to the same kinds of protections as consumers that everyone else is in the state. And we do not believe that a deregulation of the small companies should go that far. These people would not be able to contact our office with complaints. They wouldn't have the protections. And we think it's a bad bill, and it's not in the public interest. And deregulation is intended to deregulate the rates and the bureaucracy that people have to go through, but it's not intended to remove them from the basic consumer protections that the PUC provides.
Thank you. Ashley?
Yes, for the record, my name is Maury Astley with the Oregon Independent Telephone Association. I apologize, I was down working up bill in another committee. First of all, I think I may have left the wrong impression last time with Representative Pickard, and I want to make sure that what I'm saying here is not a matter of not trusting the commission. We have a difference in philosophy on some things, but I have a good working relationship with the commission, and it's just really a matter of how we look at how things should be in rate. We worked very hard in the last couple sessions on deregulation, including the small company bill that passed the deregulated companies under 15,000. And we chose to exempt companies from under regulation on a section-by-section basis and we removed them from things like rates, affiliated interest, reports, forms, and the kind of day-to-day management things that the commission is involved in. And it's difficult to do it in some other way. We could have just totally deregulated them, but we wanted to leave some protection for the consumer in the area of rates and complaints and so forth that Commissioner Rikas just talked about. At the last page of my testimony, if you'll look at that, there's a list of the telephone companies. And when we worked this bill on the Senate side, I thought that it did apply to some of the larger companies who have small subsidiaries, but I've since been told that that's not true. So it does only apply to the companies on the right. And I'll just tell you quickly what this chart is. The companies on the left serve 96% of the customers. They are the large holding companies, including some small ones like Malheur Hometel, which is actually a Bell telephone company affiliated with US West. The group in the center there, about 2.5% of the customers, they are cooperatives not regulated by the commission except for territory allocation of joint services and I believe safety and quality of service. Basically what we're asking for these other small companies. And then the remaining 1% are the small companies, mostly around 1,000 lines or less. And they are really, what we're trying to do is put them in the same position we have with the cooperatives, leaving protection for the consumer in the area of rates and safety and quality of service. We think those are the basic requirements that you need to protect the consumer. And we've left that in there purposely. But the remaining things we think are basically management kinds of things. And I don't want to read all this testimony, but I do want to cover a couple points that I think are important. In the interim, since we've deregulated small companies, the commission has used their general rulemaking procedures to set rules on disconnection of service and other issues. And they claim regulatory power over non-cooperative small companies for any issue except rates and those things which were specifically excluded in the 87 legislation. And you might ask, why would we oppose a rule that the PUC imposes on the larger companies? We've been in contention recently with the PUC over a rule that would prohibit disconnection of local service if the customer is not paid for long distance or other charges that aren't tariff. Included in the rule originally was a requirement that payments received must be allocated on the bill to local charges first. The industry doesn't like this bill. It's a hardship for the industry, but it's even more so for the small companies who have fewer customers to spread these costs over. And one example would be a software change that the PUC has now agreed to drop would originally cost $30,000 for Western Teledata, which is a billing company. Many of these small companies are too small to do their own billing, so they have a contractor. And of the seven companies this company served, only two of them really would have been using their services and been under compliance. They had to be under compliance with this rule because most of the rest were cooperatives, and the rule does not apply to cooperatives. So those two companies with about 3,000 customers would have had to absorb the $30,000. And even dropping the rule, the billing company still tells me that there will be software changes required because of the disconnect notice procedure that we currently send out has to be modified when it's sent out to the customer. Plus, when the customer rep is trained to watch these things, there's a thing called account aging, which means that you have to determine if the customer has been paying enough of a partial payment to at least cover their local service so that you can't terminate them. So that requires some software changes so that the account can be aged, so that when the customer rep pulls it up on the screen, she can look at that. In talking about the need for these rules, we have looked into the specific rules to see what kind of a problem there really is. And of the 16,000 customers, there's only one medical certificate. And I think the reason for that is that when we have those kind of situations, generally these small companies, since they're locally owned, and the people who live there and work for the customers, they tend to do things and extend credit and things that might not be in a larger company where there's a set of rules that have to be pretty rigidly followed. We looked at this issue of disconnection for local service, and less than 1% of customers are being disconnected for non-payment, and most of those aren't making any payment at all. So that's a small problem. And the deposit rules, even the cooperatives use the deposit rules that are current tariff what we call a model tariff that OITA puts out for small companies who don't have their own tariffs department. They can use a model tariff that we've built for them. And it has deposit policy in it, which has been approved by the commission. And it says that you can collect up to 2 months of prospective toll. And so that ranges from about $30 to $100, depending on the size of the company and what they've decided is a good amount of deposit that they should collect. So that's the kind of rules that they're looking at, and it's understandable their concern. We're saying that their concerns aren't that big a problem, particularly in these small companies that are owned and managed by someone living in the community. And I mentioned that this does not apply to the holding companies who could petition for re-regulation, or for regulation. If you remember last session, we had a few companies that were affiliated with like U.S. West, and we thought that they should be reviewed by the commission before they're allowed to have deregulation. The language in this bill does not apply to them, so it would only be these small companies.
Thank you.
Just a little bit more, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
We have only had one problem during this interim, and that was a company who raised their rates from $8 to $10. And the main problem was that they didn't give very good notice to their customers. This guy, you know, he mows his own lawn. He's out there doing that kind of stuff. People walk in, pay the bill. It's one of those towns that has one street through the middle. And, you know, about 30% of the people come up and give him the money and the bill in hand. So he felt that that was it. He's kind of a crusty old individual. And he just, that's the way he deals with people. And so 10% of them, and only in his case, it only took 35 people. Down at a Grange meeting on a Saturday night, and they all signed the petition, and we went through the process, and the commission found that not only were the rates reasonable, he probably could have gone up about $6, as he's only up to 10 a month now. So the problem really wasn't a matter of guys ripping off his people with high rates or anything, it's just improper notice. And you passed Senate Bill 71 out of here just recently, which will require that notice to be better notice. So clearly we've not seen abuses on this, and we do feel that it is in the spirit of what we've been trying to do the last couple of sessions. Representative Parkinson, you and I had talked earlier about the amendment on notice, and there I kind of tried to review my thinking on that. And there is still a requirement in the legislation that we have a financial report with the PUC and notify the customers. And what we removed last time was the language that it had to be in the telephone book.
Questions?
Just hypothetically, I appreciate your point about these companies tend to be owned by people who live in the community, but is there any requirement for that? If Donald Trump, for example, just hypothetical, just decided there's a lot of money to be made in small-town telephone companies, and he went in and bought the Asseton Telephone Company, Cascade Utilities, Eagle Telephone System, run down for all of those, could he do it?
Yeah, let me give you a good example. I think the best answer to that is that Asseton, for example, is owned by TDS, which is a large holding company, but it doesn't have enough presence in Oregon to qualify under that affiliate interest thing. They have a resident manager. He lives there, and he's responsible for it, and he operates basically the same way that Bob Latin does over in Eagle. He lives there, he's a participant in the community.
But some are not, they don't necessarily have to be owned by anybody who even lives in Oregon.
No, in fact, People's telephone company is not a cooperative, but it's mostly owned by people that live in the community, but it's no longer a cooperative, and it is a company that falls under this. Again, the manager, there is a manager there who owns a pretty good share of the stock, but they didn't let him get a controlling interest, so he works for the company, he's a manager, but he lives in the community.
Thank you. Other questions? None. Thank you very much. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 913. And I would at this point ask unanimous consent to allow Representative Pickard to vote on SJR 41. Any objections? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Pickard.
Aye. Thank you. At this point, I will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 205. Mr. Young, Bill Young.
He was up.
There he is.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, are we not going to have a work session on 9/13?
No.
Okay.
Carol, will you check and see if Dave Nelson or I think being Tom O'Connor on the home?
Doesn't matter to me. I'm happy to share.
What are we on, 205?
We're on 205, hearing on 205. The water bill. Come on up. Go ahead, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Young, Department of Water Resources. Senate Bill 205 is a bill that establishes two or three new approaches in dealing with transfer of water from one location to another in and outside the state of Oregon. Bill makes it clear that if water is to be transferred out of a basin, that the commission must ensure that there is sufficient water reserved for future use within that basin. The commission has to be able to determine that there's no injury to current users or to in-stream water rights in that basin. It requires the public hearing be held and requires that if there's a transfer of water of more than 20 cubic feet per second, that requires not only commission approval, but legislative approval as well. The problem we're trying to deal with is this. The state of Oregon and a number of other states have had on their books for some period of time specific provisions having to do with transfers of water out of state. In the case of the state of Oregon statute, it simply says that rather than being treated like anyone else who might apply for water, if water is to be transferred out of state, it must have legislative approval. In 1983, the U.S. Supreme Court reviewed that matter and concluded in a case called Sporhays versus Nebraska that a very similar statute in the state of Nebraska was simply constitutionally wanting because it set up a provision different for out-of-state use of water than that existed for in-state, and the Supreme Court concluded that water was an article of commerce and that having those kinds of prohibitions specifically drawn on a state line was an impermissible interference with the opportunities for commerce. A number of the western states, ourselves included, have been casting around for ways to ensure that we still have something to say about that movement of water, and the bill that you have in front of you is our version of that, to say we're going to be interested when water is transferred out of one basin to be used in another basin, and we really don't care whether that transfer is from one basin within the state to another basin within the state, or from a basin in the state of Oregon to some use outside. In other words, it proposes to put those users on an equal footing, and our reading of the Sporhays case, at least, and the following law journal articles that have been done on it would suggest that because it is an even-handed approach to the use of water, would survive that challenge that one talks about. The bill preserves...
Excuse me just a minute.
Can I just ask a question on that? Absent all of the legislative requirement for transfer out of state,
mm-hmm.
where does the jurisdiction apply over issuing a water right? Is it the point of diversion or the point of use?
Point of diversion typically represents a cost.
So if somebody wanted to, from Idaho, say, came in, wanted to divert water from a point within this state, they'd have to come and apply to us.
That's correct.
They wouldn't have to apply to Idaho.
They may also have to apply to Idaho for permission to apply water in a particular location, but they certainly would have to come to us to talk about diversion.
And typically those would be the case, Idaho, Washington, right now, within the same basin. But across state lines.
Say that again, I'm sorry.
There are some where you would be in the same basin, but across state lines on the Walla Walla.
It is conceivable that you could find small locations where you would be within the same basin or major sub-basin and still might find yourself going across the state line. Sucker Creek, a small stream on the border between Oregon and Idaho, probably is an example of that. Where we have users that divert in one state and use in the other state, and we continue to try and work cooperatively with Idaho to deal with that. Clearly, I think the intent of the Senate as they were looking at this bill was to try and get at the large diversions, the diversions that potentially at least created the specter of the kind of interbasin transfers that have occurred in California out of the Mono Lake Basin, or out of Owens Valley toward the more populated areas.
Mr. Chairman, one follow-up question on it. Who has diversion on boundary waters like the Snake and the Columbia, or, I mean, jurisdiction?
I'm not sure that I can give you a very good answer for that, Representative Hostica, other than to say that on such facilities, such as those that Idaho Power has on the Snake River as an example, we do issue a authorization, a hydroelectric license on those facilities. I guess that's about as far as I can go. If we have people who apply for water out of the Columbia River, we issue a permit for those, and my suspicion is that the state of Washington does the same. For most of the major river basins in the West, those issues have been dealt with through the use of interstate compacts or river basin commissions. Here in the Northwest, those have been used only sparingly. In our case, we have two such agreements on the Klamath Basin and in the Goose and Summer Lake Basin, but there is no such overall agreement amongst the using states in the Columbia system.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment. There's always a specter hanging over that nobody knows if it'll ever be realized or not, of California looking at the Columbia. Does this still give us authority, the state of Oregon authority, to be a player in that issue?
Yes. Yes, it would. We have suggested, in addition to the bill as it came over, Mr. Chairman, the I guess it's the A engrossed version that you had. We do have a couple of amendments that we've offered, and I think those have already been distributed to your staff. The purpose of those amendments is to make clear that we're not attempting to further burden municipal projects that are already in the business of transferring water from a basin into other basins of use. And language has been proposed in those amendments to try and make it clear that some of the provisions of the bill specific to the transfer do not apply to those already existing circumstances, even if they might enlarge. The last thing I did bring with me, and it really gets to the issue that Representative Hostica just mentioned, there is a publication that now makes its way around the West called Water Market Update. It's done by Steve Shoup, who's a water lawyer and engineer from New Mexico. And I brought along some copies of the latest version of that, because it does talk about this question of the import and export of waters, and comments, as you will note in the highlighted sections, that in the state of Nevada currently there is a resolution that takes official note of the considerable flood water that reaches the ocean here in the Pacific Northwest and encourages the federal government to pursue what might be done to look at the potential for regional transfer of that water. And similarly, although that resolution has not passed, at least as of the time of this writing, they do comment on another resolution that they've passed that encourages an interstate organization, the Western States Water Council, to look at that question of potential interbasin